Okay, so we'll move to item 23, the executive officer's report to the board. Mr. Briggs?
With the idea that we'll get back to public comment.
Yes.
Afterwards, because we've had some other cards trickling in. Okay, so for item 23, and we'll also get back to item 21 and 22. We haven't covered those yet. We're holding those over until later, in deference to the people who have been waiting. So for item 23, we want to focus initially, again, in the interest of time, the people are waiting, on the two items that are in the executive officer's report regarding Department of Pesticide Regulation and their draft surface water regulations, coordination with Department of Fish and Game, specifically regarding aquatic habitat issues. And then, as I said earlier in the meeting, we're going to roll into this discussion the implementation status that we gave you in item 12. And Angela, you were going to start things off, I believe. Angela Schroeder of our staff. Michael, can you crank that up a tap, please? Is that microphone movable?
No.
Hello, hello?
That's working.
Okay, let me just talk a little closer here. So the items in the EEO report related to the agricultural order is follow-up to the July workshop. At the July workshop, board members asked staff to clarify the relationship between the authority of the board and DPR, as well as how we coordinate with Fish and Game. So we put specific questions within the EO report about those two items. We have DFG staff here, person Mike Hill, as well as, I believe, a DPR representative.
That's Mr. John Sanders, chief of the Environmental Monitoring Branch, right there.
And as part of that, and if the board would like me to do this, I also have a few slides that will summarize the public input that and outreach that we've done thus far related to the order. So should I start with that first, and then we'll get to the coordination with other agencies? Okay, I won't go through this in great detail because actually Mr. Schimmick outlined this already. So we started the Ag Order outreach in December 2008, and that started with our Ag Advisory Panel. We did that for approximately 3 months between December 2008 and February 2009. At that point, both Water Board staff as well as members of the panel felt that we would make more progress with facilitator. So we had a facilitator come in from the State Board and met several times between March 2009 and September of 2009. In December, we brought an update to the board, and at that time, the board also invited stakeholders to present alternatives. They had 4 months to produce alternatives, and we received three. We also, in February, released a preliminary draft agricultural order that was in response to board's direction and also in response to requests from stakeholders that they wanted a more specific idea for what staff was thinking. We also had 16 outreach events and meetings where Water Board staff went out to stakeholders including ag industry, environmental organizations, as well as environmental justice organizations, to provide the context for how we're approaching the ag order, talk about requirements, and to start getting their input as well. We also did the workshops in both May and July, and those workshops were well attended and I think represented a lot of the stakeholders in the region. So that's what we've done just through July of 2010. Since the workshop in July 2010, staff has also been proactively trying to get additional input from stakeholders. This is a list of stakeholders that staff has contacted. The discussions with these individual stakeholders varies from answering their questions to asking questions about their comments. But I just wanted to show you sort of the breadth of just since July of the outreach that we've attempted here. In addition, and as was mentioned, staff has also attended four different stakeholder meetings. The first was held on August 16th, and that was with California Farm Bureau Federation, Coalition, Grower Shippers, and many other ag industry reps. And the following day, we met with environmental organizations as well as the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. We also met with the nurseries and garden centers, and then also with the SLO Farm Bureau and local ag reps. We've also scheduled an additional meeting with the Strawberry Commission upcoming. And we also held one public meeting, and that was on August 16th, and that was for our CEQA scoping. So going back, just to show you sort of the nature of input we're trying to get and that we're receiving, this is what we showed the ag panel in December 2008. And we talked about what our goals were and our legal requirements, and we were seeking specific input on targets, points of compliance, how we would confirm compliance with monitoring and reporting, what some milestones were to be to measure progress, and also time. So in December and actually up to now, our goal isn't necessarily to incorporate requirements that dictate how we do that, but how we get to these points. And unfortunately, as of now, this table is still not filled in terms of input. So we have not received specific input on targets, compliance, monitoring, milestones, or timeframes. That's not to say that we haven't gotten lots of comments. We've gotten 1,200 comment letters. We are reviewing those comment letters. We're summarizing them to figure out what the key issues are. We've also received the three alternatives. And you know, while we're still talking about the benefit of stakeholder outreach, I did want to mention that we have received some detailed recommendations from the nurseries and garden centers. So we did have a positive outcome of those meetings, and the recommendations that they've given us are specific to tiering. So yet we still haven't gotten some of these other things like targets, points of compliance, monitoring. We did receive some specific recommendations that's very helpful from the nurseries and greenhouse representatives. So this, in summary, is where we are in terms of what we have attempted to achieve in public outreach, the input that we've received thus far. We will use all of this input to inform the next revised draft order and any input that we can receive up until that release. So this is, if you have any questions, this is sort of where we are.
Angela. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Angela, you said that you've gotten some input to fill in this table, and you mentioned the nursery growers have provided some input on filling in the table. How about the environmental groups?
The environmental groups, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. The environmental groups are mainly supportive of staff's draft order. However, what is different is that they have submitted comments to suggest that our time frame for compliance is too long in some cases, and so they would like to see some shorter time frames.
Has the Farm Bureau provided any specific input?
Not relative to these specific issues. We have received lots of input comments from the Farm Bureau, but nothing regarding these specific points.
So Out of all those 1,200 comments and three alternatives, you couldn't fill any of this in?
What we have received thus far is what the general comment is, what staff has presented is not workable. We haven't received.
We have filled this in.
We filled this in.
No, I understand that, but you couldn't tell from these other 1,200 comments what fill it is in for them.
We have not received information that would allow us to put a difference.
Thank you.
Except, as you said, the environmental group's alternative did have specifics as far as milestones and that sort of thing.
And the nursery growers have provided some information.
Right, but that's related to tiering. In terms of how we might prioritize nursery growers for requirements. So we have not yet, even in that instance, gotten to targets, points of compliance.
And so where this table came from is when we decided to reconvene the Ag Panel in December of 2008, we said, what do we want the Ag Panel to do? What is its purpose? And we put this together and said, this is what we have to do as a regulatory agency. We have a statutory obligation to fill in this table, put it in an order, and present it to the board. So we, on the left-hand, that left-hand column that's in light green, these are the things that are legal requirements. They're on the table. We have to address them. Statutory requirements to address them. The rest of the columns are flexible. So that, we said, that is where we need your help to fill in this information so we can bring it to the board. That's what we've been asking for 2 years.
Have you specifically sent this to Farm Bureau?
Yes, this was the subject of the advisory panel meetings.
Where that was over a year ago, right?
Yes.
We haven't had any advisory panel meetings in at least a year.
Yes, we presented it over and over and over again.
Okay.
This was also discussed, when staff was setting up the most recent stakeholder meetings, we reminded stakeholders again that while we welcomed any input, we really needed to focus on getting these specific issues addressed.
Okay. Any more comments or questions at this point?
Okay. So if there's no questions about that, then I'll just, we should proceed with any questions about DPR coordination. And then we have DPR representative here.
Okay.
I guess if the board had any questions, we didn't prepare a presentation.
okay. Well, Dr. Sanders is here. Would you mind coming up, Dr. Sanders? I appreciate your input into what was put into the staff report.
Mr. Chair, Bob Lilly, the San Luis Obispo County Ag Commissioner, is here as well. We don't have any other Ag Commissioners here, do we? Okay. Thanks for being here.
Have you, Dr. Sanders, had a chance to specifically look at staff's proposed order?
I've had staff review it, yes. I've looked at the initial order, yes.
Right. Is there anything that jumped out at you that would be in conflict with DPR's mandate or regulations?
The primary point that we were concerned about, as we understand your authority, you cannot require specific mitigation measures. You can require things like a water quality management plan, which then people put in the management measures and things like that, and you approve that. But outside of that, in the draft order, there was, besides the requirement for the management plan, there's also a requirement for a 50-foot or some kind of buffer zone for applications of pesticides. From our perspective, that falls under our purview because our authority focuses on the sale and use of pesticides to protect people and the environment, whereas your authority is basically aimed at discharges. And from our perspective, that particular requirement of a buffer zone fell into our purview and not yours. That was our primary concern.
Okay. Do you you require any kind of buffer in, you know, with your regulations for the application of pesticides?
Yes, we do.
And what is it? How do you define that? Is it a,
well, we don't have any in place right now, but the draft that we're working on, we basically had a lengthy, over years, process where we dealt with all the stakeholders, including the various regional boards, ag commissioners, agricultural groups, environmental groups, who solicited input. We put out a draft of what we were thinking of, which we're not required by law to do that, but we know this is a very important issue, and so we did that to try and get something that everyone can live with and we believe are effective. So right now we've taken those comments, and we've got lots of comments just like you guys do, and my staff has revised that, and it's under internal review right now, and we plan on, after that happens and my management's signed off on that, we'll be asking the commissioners to comment and dealing with them, because there are local representatives on the enforcement side. We will then be going to the Office of Administrative Law with a formal package, which then starts the time clock for public comment and that whole process. Essentially, as I look at it, our draft regulations, if they're adopted as we've proposed, they're basically built on what I would call reduced use principles and pollution prevention principles. Primarily, we don't have a big database on mitigation measures and how effective they are throughout the state of California. These are meant to be statewide regulations. That's a hard thing to do because we have a lot of unique situations in California. So it's very hard to fit something together that's going to fit for the whole state. But that's our attempt to do it. We see that as only a first step. We have every intention, I think, of adopting some regulations, although I don't want to mislead you that this is going to solve the toxicity problem. We believe it will reduce the adverse impact of pesticide use, but it probably won't eliminate the toxicity that you're concerned about, not this first step.
And when you say the toxicity that we're concerned about, we both represent the state,
yes,
California, so I hope it's a shared concern.
There certainly is.
For the, you know, end result.
Yes.
Here. We just define it. I mean, that's more of what we focus on, and I know you're kind of more focused on the application of pesticides.
All I mean to say is that although we may be concerned about that toxicity too, this first set of regulations is not going to eliminate toxicity from these pesticides, I would suspect.
Okay. Do you envision that there'll be a buffer set up statewide for surface waters?
The way they would probably be structured is there's going to be a list of pesticides this applies to. It won't apply to all pesticides. In the original draft, it had 70 pesticides. I don't know if that 70 is going to survive or not, but it would apply to 70 that we felt were a particular concern. It was based on basically we keep a surface water database of detections, and we had 70 that were detected in the state of California, so we started with that. And essentially then, depending on the kind of application you make, if you're doing an aerial application, you're going to have a bigger buffer zone than if you're doing a ground application. So it's set up like that. I think the minimum is something like 25 feet, and the maximum is probably 150 feet, something like that, is what we were considering.
Right. Okay. Mr. Chair, can I interject something there?
Yeah.
When we have the discussion about the similar coordination with fish and game, and we're talking about riparian corridor and buffers with regard to creeks, and I want to make sure we know that we're talking about different buffers here, because when you're talking about 150 foot setback for aerial, that doesn't have anything to do with buffers or vegetated areas to protect a creek.
No, this is basically from the edge of field to the sensitive water site.
Right, two different kinds of buffers.
Yeah, they're not. I'm not familiar with the fish and game is requiring.
Yeah.
These are the ones that we've kind of employed in the past.
It's the same words. I want to make sure we're keeping them distinguished.
Right.
Okay. And then you mentioned the detection of pesticides in surface waters. What is your kind of trigger point? I mean, in terms of wanting to take some kind of action, is it okay for pesticides to appear at any level in surface waters, or is there some level you've determined is not good?
Our law talks about uncontrolled adverse effects, which is not defined in the law, and we have not specifically defined ourselves. It's been on a case-by-case basis. In the past, we have used Water Board guidance about toxicity issues for putting pesticides into reevaluation, and we're basically concerned about the standards you might put into place. Basically, historically, our department has been concerned about worker health and safety and public health. We haven't had a lot of experience in the environmental protection part, and essentially our law talks about protecting the environment, and that's kind of the extent of it, particularly with surface waters. There's nothing more in the law than that. And so we've got this, it becomes a much more complicated issue to protect the environment than it does, if you think about it, human health. We basically know what it takes to protect human health, reduce exposures. When it comes to the environment, it's a more complicated, complex issue, as I'm sure you're going to find out, and I already know. So this is kind of the regulations we're talking about, although we did adopt some dormant spray regulations previously that had buffer zones, and but applied only to the dormant spray type applications usually associated with orchards and things like that in the wintertime. We did that in, I think, 2007. These we're contemplating now would build upon that and maintain the dormant spray concerns or restrictions that are in the current regulations.
Can you explain dormant spray? What is that method?
It's well known among the industry anyway, but basically it's whenever a plant is in its dormant state. It's usually referring to, say, orchard type almond orchards and things like that. They apply applications that kill insects and also basically eliminate the need for applying insecticides in season, like in June and July and August. So it's a good approach for pest management, but it also, because of stormwater runoff and things like that, you can have toxicity based on some of the compounds that are used. Did that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Dr. Sanders, you answered the chair's question earlier about when he asked you about conflicts between our draft order and your purview and that sort of thing, and you mentioned the some of the application requirements and referred to your developing the draft surface water regulations. And what we had in our draft, I think, pretty much parroted your draft regulations. I think there was maybe one relatively minor exception. So Angela can correct me if I'm wrong, but it looked to me like staff was looking for, well, what are some ways to address that toxicity issue up there, saw that this is what you were proposing, and included that in our preliminary draft. And your point is, well, those haven't been adopted yet, so to include it would be inappropriate. And even if it's adopted, in that case, it would just be redundant. So anyway, I just wanted the board to know that what we came up with, it was actually reflecting what they had in their draft surface water regulations. Any addition to that, Angela?
I was just going to say, we actually coordinated with DPR staff, and we're discussing that, staff agrees, with this notion of application versus discharge, and we're working to revise language to reflect that. And the inclusion of the language was also reflective of the fact that they were not yet adopted. And so if you look closely at the language, it says there's a note there about related regulation by DPR. It was sort of reflecting back to their draft surface water regs with the expectation that they might come to bear before this order was done. We weren't sure about that. So we're coordinating with them on that and trying to keep them connected.
Has it gone to the OAL yet?
No. The adoption probably, if it goes forward according to our schedule, probably wouldn't happen before the end of 2011.
Yes, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, Chair. Just in looking at the staff report, it was seems staff was not able to make a clear statement about how enforcement of the new regulations and compliance would be assessed. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that for us.
I would start out by saying, first of all, we have a different enforcement paradigm than the board does. Essentially, you deal with individual permit holders on almost everything. We have a two-tiered system in California on pesticides in the sense that we have a restricted materials list. That's about 50 or so compounds that are called restricted materials. A grower, would, if he wants to use that, has to go in the Ag Commissioner's office and speak with the commissioner, get a permit, apply permit conditions to that, restrictions, before they can use that. But the vast majority of compounds in California are not restricted materials. And most of these compounds we're talking about of concern are not restricted materials. So essentially, if we adopted statewide regulations, the commissioners would be responsible for implementing those. But there's not the resources to put a lot of effort into enforcing those regulations. The way the commissioners go about it, first of all, they develop an annual plan of priorities in consultation with our enforcement branch. So and that's generally reflected, that plan is reflected in whatever problems they have in that county. For example, if they have worker safety issues, they would focus their investigations, their inspections on that. They do inspections. They're required to do so many inspections, 5% of the total restricted materials. So if during the matter of that inspection, they, for example, came across something, the inspector would look to see if they were also enforcing these particular, if we adopted these regulations, they would look at that and say, okay, are you meeting those requirements? That's essentially the way it works. But of course, they're doing very few, they're not inspecting every grower, they don't inspect every discharge, they don't take samples. Historically, the commissioners, restrictions and everything are generally set up so something that they can observe. Like if you, you know, for a worker or something like that, if you've got a half-face respirator that's required to reduce exposure, that's something you could observe. The commissioners are not set up to take samples. They don't take air samples or surface water samples or groundwater samples. If any of that needs to be done, my department does it, or we get the registrants to do it, or we rely on other people's data. So, for example, we're not relying on the commissioners to go out and enforce or to inspect every grower that uses these compounds. What we would do, essentially, is either DPR will conduct surface water monitoring, we'll require the registrants to do it, or we'll rely on somebody else who's already taking samples, and over a number of years, see how are we meeting any standards or toxicity issues. If we're not, we'll be circling back to add further restrictions to the regulations. That's how our paradigm works. We're not basically investigating each and every grower and each and every application of a pesticide. We don't have the resources to do that, neither do the commissioners to do that. So I'll be very clear about our kind of paradigm. It's very different from the board's.
So what triggers that kind of water sampling that you just described? What would move DPR to that action?
Well, essentially, if we put these into regulations, we'll be conducting some sampling ourselves, or we'll get the registrants to do some sampling over time. Again, we're not going to be sampling the whole state every year or anything like that. We'll have to prioritize it like we do everything else.
But that mechanism hasn't existed until these proposed regulations were put together.
No, we have that in place already. My staff is out even now we are conducting monitoring in various locations. We're looking for problems. We're not in the mitigation phase yet because we don't have any regulations in place for this particular issue. But we always have ongoing monitoring studies that are going on. Again, I don't have the staff or the resources to sample every water body in the state, but we prioritize things and go where we also use the use report as much as possible to prioritize where things are being used, because if compounds aren't being used, you're generally not going to detect them.
The labeling requirements that are found on these compounds, on the bottles and containers, do they address application of the compound to ensure protection of the aquatic environment? Or is it mainly for human health protection?
The federal labels address both. But, and you've got to realize that the label is a federal law. To not apply it according to the label is a violation, and you can be fined or whatever. But again, there's not somebody there looking at every application to see whether somebody is doing it properly or that sort of thing. There's also the way US EPA works is many of the environmental statements are often guidance and not violations that could be actually prosecuted. The human health ones are usually generally much more strongly worded. For example, you might have an environmental statement that said, do not apply this near waters, it can be toxic, or don't let it run off. Well, again, that may be more difficult to enforce because it's not very specific. And there's not somebody there taking a sample. You know, in surface waters, if it's a moving body of water, you know, it's there after the application, then it moves off site, it's gone. So it's very critical when you take those samples. So I would say that although there's concern at the federal level and they put statements on those labels, again, what's the enforcement? How does that come about? Again, it has a different paradigm than what the board is used to. That's how I would explain it.
Right. Well, it seems like then if, you know, when the ag commissioners are doing their inspections, they're primarily focused on employee safety and things of that nature, that if application is not in process during the inspection, then there's no real way for anybody to know whether the labeling requirements are being followed. And if you're not taking any surface water quality samples, your agency is not going to know what's going on.
I think that's correct.
Unless someone else is.
That's probably correct. That's the reason why we don't use that as a loop back. We would use regional monitoring.
Right.
And that, again, a multi-year process, because you essentially can't take just 1 year's worth of data on that sense and say we're meeting the standards or we're not meeting them. But basically we'd use that data to say, you know, after 2 or 3 years we're not meeting the standards, then basically we'd have to be back in the mode of further restrictions, implement through regulations. That's the paradigm that we use for environmental protection.
You know, we've heard, Dr. Sanders, from some of the from some ag folks that there's just no way for them to meet a zero toxicity standard in receiving waters, that it's just going to be like an impossibility. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I would tend to agree. Data would indicate that 1 to 2% of every application moves off-site. 1 to 2% of the mass of the material moves off-site. Now, that could be in the air. That could be in the surface water. I think, generally speaking, for most of these pesticides, they're toxic compounds we purposely put into the environment for pest management. Many of them are insecticides. Therefore, they're going to be toxic to many aquatic insects. And we're talking about standards that Region 5 has developed, for example. You're talking about one part per trillion as a standard. I sincerely doubt that you can continue to use pesticides and not exceed a one part per trillion standard in surface water. That's what I suspect.
A comment here, an answer to a question number 6 on page 7, and staff put in here, staff has worked with DPR and the manufacturers to understand how these pesticides enter surface waters and which management measures prevent them from entering surface waters from agricultural and urban lands. Do we not have a body of knowledge or science on that issue before this problem has popped up for us in Region 3?
Well, I guess it depends on who you talk to. But
okay.
For example, my own staff has conducted studies on, like, vegetated dishes.
Okay.
And looked to see how pesticides would be extracted by a vegetated ditch. And the problem is, it depends on what pesticide you're talking about, the angle of the ditch, you know, how fast the water moves through there, what plants you're talking about. In order to make a statewide regulation, we'd have to do a heck of a lot of data to determine what should be the density of plants, which plants should be used, the velocity of water where this is effective, and then it depends on what pesticide. Are you talking about a pyrethroid, or are you talking about an OP? it's variable. And there's not a large amount of data on that. There's some data on that. There's data on vegetative ditches. It may not apply to pesticides. It may apply to nutrients and that sort of thing. But again, it depends on what pesticide you're talking about, the density of plants, what plants, what kind of plants you're going to plant. That kind of broad information that's going to be applicable to California is not available. That's the reason why our current draft regulations doesn't depend on specific mitigation measures that I have data on.
Can a properly designed vegetated buffer with the right angle, the right plants, capture pesticides?
Yes, it can. The data shows that it can, but it's not 100% effective.
And elsewhere in here, there was discussion about a compound. I hope I'm getting the right one. Is it Loram or something like that? Angela, do you know which one?
LandGuard.
LandGuard.
Yes. That's a commercial product. It's an enzyme that can deactivate some of the OPs. Yeah. And I think they have a new one out for some of the pyrethroids. As I understand it, that's an enzyme. It was actually developed by the Australian government that then licensed it out to private industries to sell it. It is available in California. I don't know how widely available. I think it's expensive. I've seen data that would indicate it's very effective. But I think it's, I don't know the economics of all that. But it does seem to work, at least for chlorpyrifos and diazinon, and at least I understand there's some pyrethroid enzymes out there too, which I haven't seen the data for that.
Okay. All right. Any other board questions or comments? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. For
making the trip down here to answer questions and to give us input on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So we have Fish and Game.
Right, Mr. Hill.
Good afternoon, Mike Hill, Fish and Game, environmental scientist.
Okay.
Hi.
Have you looked at our proposed draft order?
I've seen parts of it. Essentially, you're proposing a buffer strip of vegetation between the outer edge of riparian vegetation and this disturbed field.
Right. Does that conflict at all with your jurisdiction?
No, it really doesn't. The reason I say that is that under Section 16.2 of the Fish and Game Code, we have authority to regulate activities from the edge of, the top of the bank and the riparian zone, cross the stream to the other top of bank and riparian zone. You're actually proposing a buffer that would be outside of our 16.02 jurisdiction. So if there's a project where somebody is doing work in a stream, we can add a buffer as a condition to that. Or if we have an enforcement action under our pollution law, Section 5650, we can require a buffer zone from the outside edge of the riparian zone. But generally speaking, no, your proposed does not conflict with ours.
Okay. And what our staff is focused on doing is protecting riparian corridors.
Right.
Does Fish and Game have any information that it collects in terms of riparian corridors that have been impaired or in a degraded state that need attention, need restoration?
We have we provided some information to staff on streams in at least San Luis Obispo, Monterey counties. Those are two of the three that I'm responsible for. I don't have access to Santa Cruz or Santa Barbara, but I know we can get that. We do also have yes, we can provide that information. We do have some information on it. We also have a program, our Fisheries Restoration Grants Program, and our coordinator for that is not here, but that does have some components in it for protecting and restoring riparian vegetation along stream corridors as well, particularly for salmonid streams.
Does Fish and Game have any ongoing effort that addresses restoration of riparian habitat or corridors?
That would primarily be through that restoration grant, the Fisheries Restoration Grants Program, where people such as Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo or some other nonprofit group will seek funds for some of the projects to help restore vegetation or restore fisheries habitat along some of the streams.
Okay. But that's strictly through grants then?
Primarily, yes.
Questions or comments? Go ahead, Dr.
Hunt. Thank you for coming here today to help us get a little more light on these questions. There is, let's see, my question is there any formal agreement or any way we can, there's a recommendation here that it would be helpful to include that project proponents must contact CDFG and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for any work proposed within riparian areas. So does that mean you're suggesting that our permit should include that requirement, or how do you see that happening?